And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Chapel Hillian Leonard Rogoff is the author of a big, thick, new book, coffee table-sized book with lots of pictures and lots of substance. It's called Down Home Jewish Life in North Carolina. It's all about the intersection of North Carolina history and the Jewish people who live here. And it's a great book. I've just loved it. And Leonard Rogoff, you've agreed to come talk a little bit about your book and about Jewish history, and thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here.
I've read one of your critics has said about this book that it is the best local state history of Jews or Jewish people ever published. And you don't have to endorse that statement, but what about the book that you've written called Down Home Jewish Life in North Carolina sets it apart from many other wonderful books about American Jews and where they live?
Well, for one thing, I really tried to root the book in the state's history. A lot of the books focus on the Jewish story, I think, to the exclusion of the larger society, and a lot of them tend to be folkloric without actually getting into the documentary record. You could go out and do a lot of oral histories and check some secondary sources. And what was interesting about the North Carolina story was not only that the story had not been told and presented, but in many ways, excepting some biographies and community histories, it had never really been researched. The primary research had not been done.
So you did that. And now, some of us know that you've been interested in Southern Jewish history for a long time and that you have an official position, I think, as president? Are you president of
Yes.
the Southern Jewish History?
Historical Society.
Historical Society.
Right.
And I know you because one of your buddies introduced me to the story of the Weldon synagogue and
right.
its what it meant to the community. But have you been nosing around in these kinds of Jewish history before? Is that what got you into this?
It was just entirely an accidental career. I mean, my academic training was in the 18th century English novel, and I had been writing for the defunct Spectator magazine, and I was approached to write a history of the Durham Chapel Hill Jewish community. They were under the assumption that it was their centennial, so I published.
So you did the research, and then it wasn't.
I did the research, and it wasn't. The community was older than they had suspected, and that was published, and then from there, you know, I was invited to speak and to edit a newsletter, and it's an entirely an accidental career.
Well, let's come back, if we can, to the special history of the Chapel Hill and Durham Jewish community, which is a large part of your book in Down Home, or in the at least in terms of recent history. But one of the things that interested me was that Jews have been a part of North Carolina history as long as anybody else from Europe has been a part of North Carolina history.
Well, there is actually one on Sir Walter Raleigh's second Roanoke Island expedition in 1585. The metallurgist, his name was Joachim Gans, was a professing Jew who was taken along to find precious minerals and actually built an assayer's oven on Roanoke Island, which has been excavated.
Nor was any part of the Roanoke exhibitions ever worked out to be permanent, at least as best we know. But this was a very temporary operation. He went on back to England.
But he was quite typical of the settlers, I actually think, for the next more than 400 years. I sort of wrestled with the idea of calling the book Down Home, because the typical story of Jews is one that they're cosmopolitans. This fellow Gans was a native of Prague, which is in the Czech Republic. He had moved to Germany and worked in the mines, and Queen Elizabeth had brought him to England to work in the British mining industry, came back, came to America, returned to England. So one, he was mobile. He was always relentless in his search for opportunity. And second of all, he was a cosmopolitan. He had Central European, English, and I guess even in some sense some American experience. And also he was a professional. What brought him here was commerce, looking for opportunity. And last of all, he was isolated as a Jew.
It one of the themes of your book is the changing attitudes about Jews as it was reflected in Europe, in England and in Europe, and that when Gantz came back to England, he didn't find England to be all that friendly for Jews, or at least for professing Jews.
He was one of the few Jews actually living in Elizabethan England at the time. They had been massacred and expelled in 1290, and some had come back into the Elizabethan court, as mostly they were Italian musicians. Gantz returned and got into a discussion with a ship's carpenter in which he asked the question, "What need hath God for a son?" A clergyman was summoned, and he repeated this conversation in Hebrew and then again in English in front of some witnesses, and he was arrested for blasphemy and sent to the court in London, and at that point he disappears from history.
So this was the, we'll say, the first North Carolina connected Jew, lost as Jews have been in Europe along the way, lost to history because of persecution, probably.
Well, a lot of the early Jews, I mean, there's this three-wave model of Jewish migration, and the earliest ones were the Spanish Portuguese. There's the famous story as Columbus was taking sail. There were shiploads of Jews who were being expelled by the Inquisition from Spain. A lot of them wound up in the Caribbean and South America. But we know, we have evidence that they were working up and down the American coast. So I could presume that there were probably some quite early, at least in coastal North Carolina.
Your book points out that that North Carolina, for a long time during the colonial period and afterwards, although there were Jewish people here, was not as attractive as neighboring states might be, for instance, Virginia and South Carolina. Yeah. Why was that?
Well, you know, as someone said, not many Jews or very few Jews came to North Carolina, but very few of anyone else pretty much came to North Carolina in those days. I mean, the coast was swampy. We had very few navigable rivers. We never developed the deep water port. There wasn't the Charleston or the Annapolis or later on the Baltimore. So Charleston had a Jewish congregation by 1749, a community that dated to the 1700s or late 17th century. A shipload of Jews arrived in Savannah in 1733. Richmond had a congregation in the 1790s, and most of the Jews who came into North Carolina were overflows of those communities. And like other North Carolinians, you find them on the coastal port where they're engaged in trade and commerce.
Trade and commerce seems to be the main factor that drew Jews to North Carolina all the way up until really fairly recent times. And what kinds of commerce drew them, and how did they happen to make their way here?
Well, I mean, that was part of the European situation, which was, you know, Jews were forbidden to own land. They were restricted from the guilds. So most of their occupations were involved in commerce and trade. And, the coast was intercolonial coastal highway, and there was ships going back and forth. And as I mentioned, the most prominent Jew in North Carolina's early history never set foot here, and that was a merchant in Newport, Rhode Island, named Aaron Lopez, who sent dozens of ships up and down the coast as part of his international trade that included Africa and Lisbon and London. And he had agents in places like Edenton, New Bern, Wilmington, many of whom were members of his extended family.
So he would, it's his, as branches of a Jewish-owned business.
Right.
The owner sent members of his family or his close friends to operate branches of his commercial business in North Carolina. And that was the main reason these people came.
And that was a pattern that persisted for 200 or 300 years. I mean, later on, as they came down, there were a lot of, especially on the coast, there were a lot of connections to Philadelphia. And then as Baltimore becomes a kind of ascendant commercial center, a lot of these migrants are coming down as the railroads develop down down from Baltimore.
We're visiting with Chapel Hill's Leonard Rogoff about his new book, Down Home, Jewish Life in North Carolina. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. We're visiting with Leonard Rogoff, a neighbor of ours here in Chapel Hill, whose new book, Down Home, Jewish Life in North Carolina, is just out, and it has received great reviews, and it's an extraordinarily wonderful book. Even if you don't read it, the pictures, it's well illustrated, and the pictures themselves kind of lead you through Jewish life in North Carolina history. I'm pressing Leonard Rogoff to tell us a little bit about how all this got started, and we've gotten to colonial times, I think, Leonard, and sort of the developing commerce. What did there were a few Jews here. How did they react to this radical revolutionary idea of independence from Great Britain?
Generally, Jews tended to be supportive of the revolution. I mean, we have evidence of Jewish Revolutionary War soldiers in North Carolina. The most prominent Jew, he actually arrived in 1792, this Jacob Mordecai. We all know the Mordecai Square.
Do you say, that's so funny, but you say Mordecai because that's really interesting, because I've never heard it said before, but always read it and pronounced it in my mind as Mordecai, but it's Mordecai.
No, you're right, it's Mordecai. Down south, it's Mordecai.
Is that okay?
Yes.
But at least among my contemporaries, I'm wrong, right.
in North Carolina, it's always been pronounced Mordecai.
Wow, okay.
Though, as you point out, Mordecai would
be the more surviving remnant is this wonderful house in Raleigh, in downtown Raleigh right now, but was part of a large plantation owned by a family that was Jewish and then intermingled with the Christian
right
neighbors, important family.
They largely assimilated over generations. So Jacob Mordecai and his two wives, he married sisters after his first a sister after his first wife died. They were actually quite devout, observant, Orthodox Jews. But the story during the Revolution, there were very few Jews in North Carolina at the time. But quite curiously, when the North Carolina held a convention to create its state constitution in 1776, a third of the convention was taken up debating whether there ought to be a religious test, and a lot of the debate focused primarily on the propriety of having Jews serve in public office. And the North Carolina State Constitution in 1776 reads that only a believer in the truth of the Protestant religion can hold public office. So there was Jews.
So we excluded Catholics and Jews and anybody else other than Protestants.
Well, they changed it in 1821 primarily because we had a Catholic Chief Justice Taylor.
You already
right? And William Gaston, who is both a Federalist and Roman Catholic, was very instrumental in getting it. So it became Christian after 1821. And it wasn't removed until 1868.
Well, this is a diversion, but it was interesting to me that they changed the Constitution to accommodate, in the case of the Catholics, changed the Constitution a little bit to accommodate an existing violation of the Constitution by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I mean,
right,
so
right.
And there were accommodations that were made for Jews as well, who were, for instance, elected to the legislature, I guess, under the Constitution.
Yeah, in 1808, a fellow named Jacob Henry from Beaufort, Carteret County, was elected to the state legislature. And a year later, his right to serve was challenged on the grounds that he was a Jew. And the debate is actually quite hysterical. I mean, people are asking, has he ever been seen eating pork? When he took the oath of office, did he have one Bible or two Bibles? And which one did he have his hand on?
Did he open the Bible and only hold his hand over the Old Testament part of the Bible?
Right.
It was one of the questions, I think.
And then he delivered a speech in defense of religious liberty that was reprinted for almost the next century and became was reprinted in an oratorical textbook.
It was printed as an example of the American spirit of religious liberty. Mm-hmm. I read it, the portions that you shared with me in your book. I read it as a wonderful lawyer-like ability to call for equal treatment for a Jew without conceding that he really did believe as a Jew.
He never once mentions in this speech that he is a Jew or used the term Judaism, but his speech very much fits into the mold of similar speeches that are being delivered in London and Berlin in defense of Jewish emancipation. So this is part of a kind of international discourse that's being held. Interestingly enough, the State Archives has the will of Jacob Henry's father, Joel Henry of Beaufort, and he signs that will in Hebrew as the son of Rabbi Hirsch Eiger, I think, and he lists the date in Hebrew also. So he did come from a Jewish home.
It's a precursor. Maybe this is just my reading into all of this, but your story is that one of the, there are all kinds of themes and threads go through your book on the history of Jewish life in North Carolina. But this one struck me as being contemporary in the sense that many times Jews have to kind of go after both objectives. And one is why being faithful to both the culture and, if they're religious, their religion, avoid the putting it in the face of their Christian or other religious friends in a way that person, if their religion says, "Don't, those guys are going to hell because they don't believe," that you don't put that in the face as a thing to argue about, but you try to reach an accommodation and still be faithful to your principles. And that's kind of the challenge that I see your recording in your history.
Well, I mean, it goes both ways, because one of the things that's happening to Judaism in this country, it's very much Americanizing, very often along Protestant models. The religious services become much more decorous, more English is brought into the service. The ethical as opposed to the ritualistic and liturgical elements are tend to be emphasized. On the other hand, you know, it's also a society that's the larger society is learning to have to redefine itself if it's going to accommodate Jews as American citizens too. And you see this as North Carolina is constantly wrestling during these periodic constitutional debates over the religious test. Is this a Christian nation or are we a republic? So North Carolinians are asking these same questions about themselves too, who they are as a people. I did read one book about the Jews of France, in which they said that the significance of the Jews is always far disproportionate to their numbers, to their objective importance.
Well, this is a side, I think, I want to, you've written a history and I'm trying to follow it, but the modern challenges, the modern situation, one of the great allies of Jewish people, particularly with respect to the support for the nation of Israel, are evangelical Christians.
Yeah.
And so there's a partnership that naturally develops along the lines of, did God promise the land, that particular piece of land to the Jewish people? And evangelical Christians or conservative Christians or lots of Christians support Jews in that idea. On the other hand, if you got into an argument or raised the question of, is this a Christian nation or is this a republic, diverse, composed of all, without any particular connection to God as he's defined by the Christian religion? Evangelical Christians would say the Jews have to live in a Christian nation. Right. I mean, it's kind of a funny alliance and rivalry at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, driving to Goldsboro, I pass I assume it's an evangelical church that has an American and an Israeli flag flying in front of it. But I think part of it is, I don't know that the Southern Christians always looked upon Jews in the same way that the Jews saw themselves. The Jews who came here, you know, there's always a push and pull to immigration, and they came here in search of opportunity, of economic opportunity. They wanted a place also where they could escape, especially if they're coming from Central and Eastern Europe, to escape persecution, where they would not be restricted in terms of the careers, where their children could get an education, where they could find security. And even in places like in Germany, for example, there were laws that only the oldest son could marry. So again, there was lots of reasons for them to come here. The Southerners tend to look upon these people, you know, as if Abraham and Sarah had just stepped off, you know, walked right out of the Bible. And saw them as God's own people, the flesh and blood of the Savior, right here in their very midst.
Well, we want to talk some more about that. We're visiting with Leonard Rogoff, author of Down Home, Jewish Life in North Carolina. He and I will be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking with Leonard Rogoff, Dr. Leonard Rogoff, I'm sorry. you're a Chapel Hillian. Are you a native Chapel Hillian?
No, I came down here in 67 and so you're grad school and stayed.
So you came and stayed?
Came and stayed.
And you know, we're gotten off course in terms. I'd just give up on doing a lineal, following your lineal history. But that is the model for many of the Jewish people who are in North Carolina now. They came and stayed.
Yeah. Again, you know, as I said, Jews tend to be mobile, but Jews are doing pretty much what everybody else says. They are hardly alone in being recent migrants to North Carolina.
Are most of the Jews who live in North Carolina today native born, or are they immigrants like you who came and stayed?
In most communities, what you'll find is a small core of multi-generational families, and then far larger numbers of people who are recent migrants. And I think that's been true at almost any point when you look at the history of a local North Carolina Jewish community.
When you moving back in history just a little bit, is anybody who reads the history of Jewish people in America knows knows this, and it's probably wrong, but we know that there was an earlier stream of immigration that came primarily from Germany, and that there developed over time a successful and almost an aristocracy, or at least a sort of high level,
right,
and tending towards assimilation in the sense that they maybe adapted to American values. And that later on came, say, around 1900 or so, in response to developments in Europe, a large group of Eastern European Jews immigrated,
right,
and that there was some tension, some difference. How did that play out in North Carolina?
Well, the North Carolina history, Jewish history, is pretty much the history of the state. And, I mean, North Carolina has been a late bloomer. Again, you know, this is another way that our North Carolina history contrasts, I think, with our neighbors to the north and south, you know, where the proverbial veil of humility between two mountains of conceit. And there, the colonial and antebellum histories, I think, are far more developed. And North Carolina really develops with the New South, with urbanization and industrialization. And that's an era that coincided with the East European migration.
So we got more, I mean, we're more mostly Eastern European rather than German. Is that
The typical pattern that you find in Southern communities is that there's an older temple founded by Germans, which is now Reform. And then there's a newer synagogue founded by East Europeans, which started out as Orthodox, but it probably is now conservative. And you have that model certainly in Wilmington, where you had the first synagogue in the state founded in 1876 by Germans.
So the ones who came earlier, that is the Germans, tended to, tended to liberalize and accommodate and, I don't want to say, and put aside some of the real restrictive rules and became more modern, whereas the Eastern Europeans, coming directly out of fairly conservative communities, wanted to hold on to the way of doing things that they'd learned growing up, speaking Hebrew or Yiddish and reading, not English, but the tongues that they knew.
Well, I mean, the truth of the matter, it really has to do not even so much with your national origin as the time of your arrival. Mm. Because the Germans who came here also came out of very traditional backgrounds. They were mostly village Jews, you know, so they weren't quite so effective.
So it was the time they'd had in America to accommodate that led them to be reformed rather than conservative or orthodox.
Yeah, I always cite Richmond, which had which in some ways is sort of a mother or a homeland for a lot of North Carolina Jews. So you have a Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in 1792, and that's followed, I think, by the 1820s. You have a Bavarians start their congregation in the 1840s. The Prussians start their congregation. And in the 1880s, the East Europeans start their congregation. And all the congregations start as Orthodox. And then over time, they start liberalizing.
I want to move to another sort of idea that those of us who aren't Jews have about Jews in North Carolina. And we have this idea that here's the typical history of a prominent Jewish family, maybe with a couple of alternative branches. But it started out when a peddler came down on his back, maybe from Baltimore, maybe from someplace, or Richmond, just selling, walking around selling to farmers. And then that he was successful, so he got a wagon or maybe a horse and got around. Then he was so successful that he started a store, and he had one of these, what some people have called Jew stores in small towns in North Carolina, and that developed. Either it stayed like that and became successful, it upgraded, it might have become a chain of stores. And then the children either came in and developed that business, stayed in that business and made it better, or that they became doctors and lawyers and moved someplace else. Now, is that
you kind of got it. I mean, there's some variations.
Oh, one other variation, and that they became interested in being suppliers, and some of them, instead of just selling cloth, decided that they would manufacture cloth.
And I mean, the Cohn brothers, for example, they came down here. Their father had a wholesale business up in Baltimore.
And everybody knows Cohn anything Mills. About Cohn Mills and Moses Cohn Hospital.
Right.
And Benjamin Cohn was the other brother. Is that the right?
Moses and Caesar.
Moses and Caesar Cohn.
Benji,
and Benjamin was a
son,
I guess.
Right. Yeah. And they started out on foot and on horseback, selling merchandise from their father's store, buying fabric, and then they invested in some mills, and before you know it, they had the largest textile mills in the South. And that is a fairly typical pattern, and a lot of a lot of, depends upon what time you're talking about, a couple of things. A lot of industrialists came down here also, people who had mills up north and came down here to buy or open mills looking for
So they skipped the peddler route and just came directly.
Yes, yes. I mean, probably one of the most distinguished was Carl Robbins, who purchased the land.
Tell this story about Carl Robbins, who I've never heard of before, I don't think, until I read in your book that, you know, our former senator, John Edwards, grew up in Robbins.
Yeah.
And at some point, I think somebody did tell me that the old name of that town had been Hemp.
Hemp, yes.
Which is other things. But the reason that it is Robbins, you describe in your book. Why is it called Robbins?
Well, again, and this is a story I've heard repeatedly also, that my families like the Bernsteins in Charlotte, the Bowers in Greensboro, their fathers had textile mills up north, and they came and they invested in southern textile mills, and they were successful. And Carl Robbins, who was a New Yorker, a Russian immigrant, and he had invested in these mills in the town of Hemp and the area around in the Sand Hills.
Near Pinehurst.
And as the Depression came, he kept his mills humming. And he was a very, very generous benefactor to the town. He paid for the school teachers, fire departments, taxes, opened up in parks. And the town was so grateful for him, to him, that in, I think it was 1943, they changed the name from Hemp to Robbins. And Robbins later on purchased the 4,000 acres that became the Research Triangle Park.
A great part of the story and great part of your book. I just have to say that there is another feature which isn't dealt with quite as much in your book, and that is Robbins isn't a Jewish name or doesn't come across as a Jewish name. Surely that wasn't his name when he immigrated from Eastern Europe.
Well, I'm sure it was anglicized. I don't know. I don't know in his particular case, but I do mention the fact that names are not a very, very reliable indicator of Jewish origins. I mean, there are Christian ministers here who have names like Cohn and Rupenberg. There are synagogue presidents who have names like Wilson and Brady and Taylor.
How does that happen?
I mean, it happens in several ways. It doesn't happen at Ellis Island, as a lot of people
Yeah, that's,
tell
yeah, yeah.
It
I happens, thought that's what you were going to say.
No, but. No. It happens when they file naturalization papers. And lots of times people want to shorten their names. A tailor, if your name is Schneider, Jews didn't get last names until the late 18th, early 19th century. A lot of them took occupational names, such as Schneider meant you were a tailor. So you might have adopted the name Taylor. Or in some cases, I heard of one case, the Patterson family in Hendersonville, that the judge was so tongue-tied by their names that he just said, "I'm calling you Patterson from now on." And whether that's family folklore or how it happened, but that's but again, it's an expression of their wanting to be American. They're not wanting to be different than their neighbors. So they're adopting these anglicized names.
Wow.
The British Jews, by the way, do it far, far more commonly than the American Jews do it.
We're visiting with Leonard Rogoff about his book, Down Home, Jewish Life in North Carolina. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Leonard Rogoff. Down Home, Jewish Life in North Carolina is the name of his book. And, Leonard, we were talking earlier, it's also the name of some associated projects.
Yeah, this is one element of a multimedia process, and we're looking at the history from a variety of perspectives. We have a documentary film, also Down Home Jewish Life in North Carolina, which is available by DVD from the and will be shown on public television. And then we have a traveling museum exhibition, which is opening at the Museum of History in Raleigh and will be traveling the state for 3 years. And also a public school curriculum. And this is all being produced by the Jewish Heritage Foundation of North Carolina.
We'll have a link to the Jewish Heritage Foundation's website, which if you want to write it down is www.jhfnc.org.
Right.
And we'll also have a link to the trailer for the video that you've been talking about. All of this intersects so that some of the things that we've been talking about and that are done so well in your book, you can go almost hands-on. You can both see and hear at the museum exhibition, and I'm real excited about the chance to go through that. I want to we've just got a minute or two. I want to talk about some of the tougher parts of your story, which interested in me. And let me just say that the two words are exclusion and quotas, mm-hmm. that were a part, particularly as Jewish presence accelerated, became a part. Jews found a wide degree of acceptance and friendship, but if they wanted to join a club of their economic and social peers in many places in North Carolina, they found that and to varying degrees, that wasn't open. And then the other thing, and this it has more of an impact here in Chapel Hill, and they found that while the word would have been that this was an open, liberal place, that there were quotas in academic institutions, when it was open, we didn't want to have too many Jews, and so we established these informal quotas. And you talk about those in your books. What part of what part did these aspects of Jewish life have in the feeling of Jews that they were welcome in North Carolina?
Well, I mean, certainly these things existed down here, but the truth of the matter is that they were felt less deeply in the South than they actually were in the North. UNC, thanks primarily to Frank Graham, who throughout his entire life was always a friend of the Jewish people, UNC was relatively open, though there were problems in the some of the professional schools, but generally...
Well, I'll just stop you right there, because one of the stories, you don't want to tell it, I guess, yeah. is that the dean, someone who's very well-respected, with good reason, Dean Manning, a hero in terms of establishing medical education,
right.
And you can put yourself in his shoes, he was limiting. He was willing to accept Jewish presence on the faculty and students, but he didn't want to be overwhelmed with it. And so he established quotas, and somebody who was looking to be admitted or be employed was rejected because of that, and Frank Graham overruled him. This is your story.
Yes.
I mean, this is...
Well, it's not my story. And on the one hand, a Jewish student, after he read my previous book when I told that story, and a doctor over at Duke, Ed Halperin, has done more primary research on it. If you want to look at Dr. Manning's personal journals, his memoirs, what he says is not very nice. Although his brother was a very, very close friend, personal physician to many Jews, and was recalled by them as a very dear friend. But publicly, on the other hand, he was sufficiently a Southern gentleman. When the student who Graham had insisted be admitted to the medical school against Manning's wishes, Manning refused to release his name to the medical schools who inquired about who the troublemaker was.
So
he was sufficiently the Southern gentleman.
But he was also the Southern gentleman enough when he was overturned by his boss, Frank Graham. He resigned as dean, I think, is
yes.
That you
well,
said.
I think. Yes, because Graham had pretty much told him that had taken that authority away from him,
and
some of the other fellow members of the faculty were quite were supportive of Manning, and I had a very wonderful friend from Chapel Hill who was a pre-med here, interested in pre-med at UNC, and just had a professor told him, "I know you're a Jew, you only want this job for the money." And another woman wrote to the Alumni Review that her father had a professor tell her he just did not give A's to Jews as a matter of
policy.
Yeah,
you got that in your book, I think. So, you got that in your book.
So, yeah, there was that. But when I talk to, when I do oral histories, almost invariably people will say, I never experienced any anti-Semitism. I always felt a part of this community.
And then they go ahead and tell you the story.
And then they will say, but.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
But will usually be a story about, you know, I went to the country club and was asked to leave, or my daughter couldn't go into the swimming pool or we couldn't play golf on the golf course, even though our home backed up to it, or some story, or I couldn't join the
library. Let me just ask you this, because we just got a minute, and is it your impression that those institutional barriers, I mean, surely there's anti-Semitism, but are those barriers still there, just in disguise somewhere, or have they pretty much been washed away?
I think they've been pretty much washed away. I mean, there is probably some, as I say, elite anti-Semitism. There is certainly some more so religious intolerance.
Can a Jew buy a house anywhere he wants to in North Carolina? Can he go to any hotel? Can he get in any club?
Oh, yeah, that has gone. But by law, that has been removed. And a lot of these barriers fell with racial desegregation.
Another topic that's well documented and well told in your book is the intersection of Jewish life with African-American progress. And it's a story that is so complicated and interesting that I think we should do another show on that, especially sometime. A great book, Leonard Rogoff, Down Home, Jewish Life in North Carolina. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for writing it. And then thanks for sharing it. And also, you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, a museum exhibit, which will be traveling across North Carolina, first at the Museum of History in Raleigh, and a wonderful video about that backs up your book and intersects with it that's being shown on UNC TV.
Okay, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, and it's been Who's Talking?